the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. Again, I'm skipping around in the texts I'm using, which are Rim Master's wonderful article on the meaning of discipleship, entitled The Meaning of Discipleship, and Durkheim's wonderful, well, excerpts from Durkheim's wonderful book, The Call for the Master. Durkheim draws a distinction, which is a distinction that I've never seen before, but that is perfectly accurate in experience, between stages of discipleship. In this text, he uses the word student and studenthood. He means disciple. It's just a bad translation or a bad choice of a word, because it should be disciple. So I'll use the word disciple where he uses the word student. He says, a person who has woken to discipleship is moving toward new human status, the status of being on the way to the way, way with a capital W, on the way to the realization, the full realization of the Dharma, of the path. Waking to studenthood is not a single step, but a multi-stage process. It begins when the inner call is experienced, listened to, and first obeyed. When the inner call is experienced, listened to, and first obeyed. Remember that River Master used to say, in Christianity, in the Bible, it says all are called, or many are called, few choose to answer. No, few are chosen. Yeah, many are called, few are chosen. And River Master said in Buddhism, it's all are called, few choose to answer. And even to begin discipleship, you have to be listening to something in your own heart and moving towards it, choosing to move towards it, not ignore it anymore. When the inner call is experienced, listened to, and first obeyed, this marks the entry to the way, the entry to the path. A distinction must therefore be drawn between two stages, waking to the possibility and waking to the actuality of discipleship. An Eastern master was once asked to define the difference between students, disciples, and masters, and answered, when a person can really call himself a disciple, he's already where the master is, on the way. Only you can see it more clearly in the master's case. And that's a really great answer. No true master regards himself or herself as in any way different from a disciple. It's just that when we are in the position of disciple and we are seeking a master, or we are being drawn to a master, the master is clearly someone who's further along the path than we are. But from the master's point of view, it's being on the path that matters. And in the end, as the scripture of great wisdom says, distinctions between near and far are lost. A true master is not concerned about distinctions between near and far. As Reverend Master says again and again, they're just concerned with doing their own training. Whether anyone joins with them in the path they're walking is not their problem. He goes on to say, this means that people who have really become disciples are no longer in danger in their constant battles with the worldly ego of betraying the never-ending process of change that leads to a manifestation of the absolute or of the eternal. That is, of rebelling against the master. And this is a really important point. I have to say that we're not talking about the distinction between, you know, between someone, say, being a lay person and becoming a monastic disciple here. We're talking about a fundamental spiritual conversion, a fundamental step in conversion, where the disciples reach the point where they have given up the fight. And it took me 14 years as a monk to get to that point. Some people reach it sooner. Some people think they've reached it, but they haven't, and it shows up much later. But rebelling against the master means rebelling against the master and the master's teaching. And attempting to, it's like a fish that's been hooked that attempts to spit out the lure. That's what it's like. Is that when you have got to the point where you're done thrashing around and there's nothing that can stop you from walking the path. Guru Master describes this really as the stage of Samantabhadra, reaching the heart of Samantabhadra. And you know, I've read this so many times, but I'll read it again because you can't read this too many times to people. She says, the true teacher can tell when the trainee, the disciple, has truly acquired the characteristics of Samantabhadra by watching his actions and reactions to the situation that the teacher is bound to create as a result of his teaching methods. And in place of that the teacher is bound to create in, as a result of his teaching methods, I'd say that, just say, as I think River Master would later in her training when she wrote this, that the naturally arising situations that occur in the in life, and that when you're in a relation to a master, a relation of discipleship to a master, the master is somehow always involved in every important thing that happens in your life. So the koan appears naturally, is what I'm saying. And the teacher doesn't necessarily have a particular method they're using. It's just, instead of word action, methods, you could say actions. But the teacher's actions evoke things, evoke reactions in the disciple. And so what she says is the teacher's watching the disciple and watching the way the disciple behaves in reaction to what the teacher does and in reaction to just normal daily life. And the proof of whether the disciple truly loves mankind with the heart of Samantabhadra, has truly realized the heart of Samantabhadra, and not just loves mankind, loves the eternal, I would say. And the love of mankind is derivative love at this point in your training. But the proof is given when, in face of all opposition, distrust, and misunderstanding, he is willing to carry on in the path that he has chosen, truly caring nothing for material things, fame, fortune, reputation, honor, life, or death. And just to show you that, I mean, in case anyone ever wondered, that River Master didn't talk about this in these kind of extreme, seemingly extreme, from the world point of view, extreme terms. From the point of view of someone who really is walking the path, it's just, this is just your attitude. This is just the way you think. But she says in the article on the meaning of discipleship, in the third to the last paragraph, if the trainee is really sincere in his training, he can always find the truth even when what the world regards as devils surround him. He must be willing to lay his life on the line if he would be reborn in the world of the Buddhas and patriarchs. The Christians have a little verse in the Bible about this. If I can remember it, he who would save his life will lose it, but he who would lose his life for my sake shall surely save it. And that's exactly the same thing. Of course, this is not being a suicide bomber. You know, people get this wrong. It's not that you go out and kill yourself for your cause. It's that there is an unconditional willingness. And health, wealth, reputation, fortune, honor, life, and death are put on the line in that unconditional willingness. You're holding on to nothing. If you would truly realize what discipleship is, you've got to let go. That's what it's saying. You've got to do just what Dogen says in the Rules for Meditation. Cut all ties, give up everything. And of course, it's something that there's a heart and a heart commitment to when one has reached a certain point in training, and one is going to do whatever one has to do. One is going to follow the Eternal wherever the Eternal leads one, without counting the cost. So this is the stage of discipleship where one is beyond the rebelling. And like I say, it took me 14 years to get that to that point. And then when I got to it, it was clearly evident to me and to Reverend Master that I'd got there. Because the fight went out of me. Now, what is it one's fighting against? The disciple thinks they're fighting against the master, that there's something wrong with the master, or that they've got to stand up to the master. But what it really is the disciple is having a fight about whether they're going to be willing to pay the full price. The disciple is having trouble swallowing the truth with a capital T, that it's going to cost them everything. And when I look back, I recognize now in myself what it was that I did not recognize it for a long time, but I recognized what it was I was fighting against. What it was I was so afraid to give up. And frankly, I have sympathy for anyone who has that fight. Because in some ways, it's harder than giving up your life. And if one wants to walk in the way of the Buddha's ancestors and realize the perfection of Zen, one's got to surrender and give up that fight. There's no getting around it. He says, those on the other hand who have merely opened their eyes to the possibility of studenthood or discipleship are still a doubtful quantity. It is true that the Absolute, the Eternal, has already touched them, and they are willing to follow and may even have promised to perform the first exercises, to undertake the discipline of training, but they are still not totally committed to the way. They are on their way to the way, with a capital W, but have not yet passed through the gate of total change, beyond which there is no turning back. He says, take the eternal prayer as a benchmark. We can say that students have passed through the gate when they no longer utter the prayer, but when the prayer utters them. I had never read this, but if you remember, those of you who were, which is just one or two people in this room who were training for me after my Sangha in the winter of 1987, I started talking about not about us meditating, but the meditating doing us somehow. And actually, I'd had experience of that before that point. I may have even been saying that before that point. But at that point, when I really surrendered the fight, you know, it came to have a whole new level of meaning. Not just something experienced in meditation, but experienced in every aspect of daily life. He says, they remain human, of course, and are thus repeatedly tempted to stand still. That's why he emphasizes that what he calls the absolute or the eternal draws us into constant change. Always we must be disturbed by the truth. The going on beyond, always going on, always becoming Buddha. There is no static nirvana. The true nirvana is the complete surrender to the eternal. And nothing less is complete nirvana. It says, they remain human, of course, and are thus repeatedly tempted to stand still, but the real danger is past. To say that they are on the way in this sense, remember with the capital W, is really to say that the way has got them and will keep them. And there could be no better explanation here of what discipleship is when discipleship becomes eternal discipleship. I've talked about times about the way that I take the Bodhisattva vows, which I do if I formally take the Bodhisattva vows, the four vows, the famous four vows, twice a month in private. I do it in private, as I've said before, because I think everyone has to decide for themselves whether they're going to take those vows to heart. And it's exactly what those vows mean that I was rebelling against all those years. So I do understand. I actually understand that you can't make someone take those vows, and that however many times someone may take them before they have truly taken them to heart, in the full, I don't know, it's not an intellectual understanding. It's in the full acceptance of what they imply. Innumerable takings of those vows before anyone takes them in that way doesn't equal the taking of it in that way in any way whatsoever. It's not at the same level in any way whatsoever. There has to be the unconditional yes that comes streaming right out of the hara, and it takes you as you let it out. You don't create it. You let it out. It's you couldn't really call it anything other than Buddha nature responding to the call of Buddha nature. And at that point, you're just a vessel of it, and you don't even exist in a real sense. And yet you had to train to get to the point. You had to make many choices to get to that point. So when I take that fourth vow, and it took me many years beyond that great yes before I could take it in this way, it took me a long time to not be scared of the implications of the Bodhisattva, of that great vow, which is the vow that takes you. the path is very long. I vow to follow it forever. The traditional way that's said is that the path is very long. I vow to arrive at the end. And there's all the difference in the world between the idea of arriving at the end and I vow to follow it forever. There's another way in which it's taken all worlds and all lifetimes to come, and that's the forever. And that's what I was so scared of. I don't want any more rebirths. And I had to come to the where I got the me out of it, and it was just that I am willing. Whether they come or not, I'll follow the eternal wherever the eternal leads. If one can train at that level, the human master doesn't pose a problem. Reverend Master Dogen quotes Dogen. She says, as Dogen rightly points out, it is not the truth or falsity of the teaching that matters, but the truth or falsity of the sincerity of the trainee. She goes on to say, and I just read this, but I'll say it again. If the trainee is really sincere in his training, he can always find the truth, even when what the world regards as devils surround him. Every master is a human being. Every master is just a human being, just as every disciple is just a human being. Every master wobbles on the path just as every disciple wobbles on the path. And they both do it with the very best of intentions. If someone comes to the point of discipleship and simply sticks on the point that they cannot find a master who is not superhuman, then they are stuck for good until they let that one go. You're only going to find a human master. And a master, every true master will be sure to let the disciples know right away that they're human. In case there's any question about it. Masters can be just as difficult and a lot more difficult to live with than your unpleasant family member that you don't want to see except at Thanksgiving dinner, and even then you prefer they didn't come, you know, it's a relief if they don't come. Masters can be gracious and kind. Masters can be bad-tempered and rude. And masters can poke you where it hurts. And masters can ignore you and simply say no to you. And that's mostly what happens. Masters tend to ignore you a lot. Why would they do that? When, you know, you're so sincere and you're putting all this into it, why would they do that? This is what Durkheim says here. You'll listen to it when I can get to it here. He says, even contact with the outer master, with the human master, serves only as repeated revitalizing spur to the inner master. The inner master is your own Buddha nature. The purpose for which you're training is not to follow a human master, but to follow your inner master, the Buddha nature. You take a human master, you follow the teaching of human master, because that teaching helps you follow your own inner master. You undertake the discipline of training, the discipline of regular meditation, the discipline of the precepts, the discipline of obedience, the discipline of following within the monastery. Because all of that helps you follow your inner master, who you have to learn to turn towards, ask, offer, wait, listen to, and follow. That's the purpose of religion. And it's the and truly contemplative religion focuses on this in a way that nothing else does. He says, if there is no inner master, the outer master has no power to transform. Indeed, there are no masters. If there is not within you the Buddha nature, if there is not within the disciple the Buddha nature, and of course there is, then everything else is pointless. You can't do anything. No human being, you know, this is not guru worship where you sit at the faithfully at the feet of the guru and one day the guru stretches out a hand and strikes you on the forehead and you're enlightened. This is a business in which you do all the work and the master points the way. The master has no power to transform that you don't bring to it. The master's actions, usually they're entirely unconscious actions, can often be a catalyst for a disciple. But the master has no magic. And masters who claim magic should be avoided like the plague. They're fools, blind leading the blind. Anyway, he goes on to say, this is also why a genuine master repeatedly withdraws, leaving this disciple to himself. In doing this, he is testing and summoning the inner master of the disciple and making way for him. Remember I said, yes, making way for him. A true master has genuine humility. What is the fundamental principle of genuine humility? I am not God. No one knows this better than someone who has walked a long way on the path. I am not God, and there is nothing in me that is not of God. But if I'm going to find that within me that is of God, I have to be consciously turning towards God and asking for help. I have to be consciously offering. I have to be consciously listening. What the master is dying to have happen is for the disciple to truly hear and follow his or her own heart. A true master is dying to be redundant, even though in fact they never are. But the reason why they never are is because of gratitude. Because when, just as River Master says in this article, and I'll read it again. The discipleship entails obedience, however unusual may be the circumstances and requests of the master, because that which the master passes on to a disciple is so exquisite, so wonderful. I can't explain this. It's because you can't explain a gratitude that is limitless. A gratitude that is just the gushing out of you of love for the Master. I've often said, in my mind and in my heart, I really view River Master Jiyu as someone who saved my life and did it more than once. Because I know that there were times in my training when I was so far out to lunch that if I had not had her pointing the way, and if I had not chosen myself to follow the path that she was pointing me down, however scary it was, if I had not made that choice, and if I had not had her pointing the way, that I would have just wallowed and possibly sunk at that point. Now you can say, well, how can you know that, you know, you would not have found your way? Well, of course I can't know absolutely. But the fact is I had River Master there, so I don't have to worry about it. I had what the Eternal gave me. I had who the Eternal gave me. I had the good sense to follow the teaching she gave me. You could say, equally say, that if you were drowning in the lake and someone grabbed you by the hair and or by the arm and pulled you out, well, you know, maybe someone else would have pulled you out at that point, or maybe you would have found a log. But the fact is that that's the person who saved you. You see? And that's how I view River Master Jiyu. And I'm not the only one who views it that way. I want to read that paragraph I just read again, then I'm going to read something else. I'm going to read the sentence I read, or the two sentences, about the master withdrawing. This is why a genuine master repeatedly withdraws, leaving the student to himself. In doing this, he is testing and summoning the inner master of the student and making way for him. People can come to a master expecting that they're going to be kind of coddled along and treated. Maybe they were spoiled in their earlier life or something. Well, I can't help it if people aren't adult. But I have to trust that people who come to me are capable of being truly adult. This is not the only place this is talked about. This is from some of the teaching, the deep teachings on the contemplative life. It says, when you reach the gate of the boundless, primordial unborn, you will understand why it withdrew its source. When you know that the Eternal is above all things, you will understand the reason why it conceals its light. When you see the Buddha nature within a snail and the treasure house within a stone, then you will understand the reason why our own house, in quotes, is made of beautiful jewels. You will, in other words, you will understand the immaculacy of your own body and mind, of your own stream of karma, the house. When you reach the gate of the boundless, primordial unborn, you will understand why it withdrew its source. When you know that the Eternal is above all things, you will understand the reason why it conceals its light. River Master used to say, what we're trying to do in this business, we're trying to be like the Eternal. We're trying to become like the Eternal. So when a master leaves you on your own to struggle with your koan, it's not out of a lack of compassion. It's out of trust in you, that you can be adult enough to rise to the occasion. That you can yourself meditate and find within yourself what the Master has found within himself. No one's going to do it for you. The Buddhas only point the way. Thou must go alone. In behaving like this, the Master is doing exactly what the Eternal does. You know, we all have the Buddha nature. Why doesn't it just show itself to us and be done with it? You know, people, again, in this fits of childish rebellion and childish temper tantrum, people get angry at God, angry at the Eternal, and even deny the existence of what really know in their heart, they know in their deepest heart exists. Everyone has the the light of true faith within them. Everyone really knows that there is the eternal, but people will deny it because it doesn't respond to our selfishness, but waits for us to let go. It waits for us to behave like spiritual adults. It seems to hide its light or conceal its light. It seems to conceal the source from us. But in fact, it does not do so. We are blinded by our greed, hate, and delusion. And it waits patiently. There is unselfish, not unselfish, selfless, unconditional, selfless love in this. Incomprehensible love. The Eternal does not try to do our training for us or live our life for us. When we have got to the point where we are truly asking, truly listening, truly following, then we experience immense gratitude for that love that does not force itself upon us, that love that trusted us all along, and that never forsook us, even when we, in our delusion and confusion, sometimes tried to deny to ourselves that it existed. But while we are insisting on having our own way, it holds us at arm's length. And this is why masters can be so hard-headed and so difficult. I've told the story many times. I'll just tell it once more because it was a perfect example of it. I was up late one night with a master when I was visiting down from this temple in the winter one year. This was just a couple of years before she died, a year or two before she died, I think. She had just one other person there, one of her chaplains, and they were making they'd been making arrangements for her summer, and where she was going to stay in the summer. And this particular individual was being very, very insistent that something be set up in a certain way, in a way that he was absolutely certain, and he may have been right, that Reverend Master would really appreciate. But the more insistent and reasonable he got, you know, he was trying to talk her into it being reasonable, the more reasonable he got, the more unreasonable Reverend Master got, and the more just stubborn and difficult. And he was getting more and more insistent, you know, why, this is, I'm trying to set this up for your good, you know, this is, you know, you're going to love this, you know, why can't you get the point, basically. He was being more polite than that, of course, but and the more reasonable he got, and the better his arguments got for how this was going to really, she was really going to like this, the more difficult and stubborn and just plain cussed Reverend Master got. And when I walked home that night, walked back to the room I was staying in at the Abbey, you know, that night, I thought, I just saw a perfect example of natural teaching. I don't think Reverend Master had any idea what she was doing there, but I just saw it myself, that the more insistent the disciple was, the more difficult the master was. She was just everything in her was simply saying no to the self. The problem was not what he was proposing. I don't even know what they ended up setting up. In actual fact, she wouldn't care one way or the other. It was the insistence. It was the self. The master's job, a great deal of the time, is simply to say no to self. The master can be incredibly flexible and accommodating kind, sympathetic, all that stuff when there's no self being projected by the disciple. But as soon as self comes out, masters get difficult, and that's their job. One day, we become incredibly grateful for that. I look back now on some slugs that River Master gave me, where she was really just saying no to me, but in no uncertain terms, and just how painful that was for me at the time, and how I struggled with it. And I look back now and I think, my God, thank God for someone who is willing to help me in that way. One day as a disciple, one comes to have sympathy for the master. Hermes used to talk a lot about this, having compassion for the abbot or having compassion for the master. Even in cases where masters go or seem to go seriously on, let's say, a side path off the main path, as sometimes does happen, and of course we all know of cases that have got publicity where masters have done things that really they shouldn't do. But even in such cases, a true disciple will work through the pain and difficulty and confusion and will come eventually to the point of gratitude. Because what your discipleship is in the end is not conditional upon the master, it's conditional upon you. What my discipleship is conditional, is not conditional, never was upon River Master. In reality, it's conditional upon me. And if I choose to go, if I choose to walk a resentful or bitter path, I only hurt myself. If I choose to walk a path of acceptance, and sympathy, and gratitude, I help myself. I count myself fortunate in my master that there was someone who so fully and so steadfastly stayed on the path. And for those whose master has, let's say, taken some more notable wobbles and detours, all I can say is that's no reason for you to abandon trust, what the fundamental trust is, or to abandon gratitude. If we choose to go a direction of resentment and bitterness, we hurt ourselves. If we choose to go a direction of acceptance, sympathy, compassion, and gratitude, we help ourselves. In the end, it's what we do to ourselves. Which is the Buddha, which is the Dharma, which is the Sangha.